I've got as the title of my sermon, The Call of Moses, but it's not really about the call of Moses per se. We're not going to spend a lot of time in, you know, going over all the details of Exodus chapter 3. It's more about the significance of the call of Moses. Last week we talked about a similar thing, the call of Abraham, and of course Abraham has a son Isaac, this one son late in life. And Isaac then has two sons, Jacob and Esau, but one of those two sons, Jacob, would become the son of promise, and his name is renamed to Israel. But during Abraham's lifetime, the only plot of land he had, you know, God said, I'm going to give you this land, look to, you know, north and south and east and west, I'm going to give this land to you. And yet the only plot of land that he ever owned was the small plot of land that had a cave in it where he buried his wife, Sarah. But he has his son Isaac, like I said, and then their son Jacob. And it's not really until Jacob's time that you kind of see this promise of many descendants start to really take place. I mean, obviously we know God's promise and things like that. But one son and then two grandsons, and only one of those is a grandson of promise. But then Jacob's name is changed to Israel, and Israel has 12 sons. And of course, you know the story that during that time, one of Israel's 12 sons, Joseph, is sold down into Egypt, and there becomes a famine throughout the whole world, that part of the Fertile Crescent anyway. And it's Joseph, one of Israel's 12 sons that got sold down into and taken down into Egypt, that ends up becoming an important ruler under the Pharaoh of that day because of his ability to interpret dreams and because God was with Joseph. And he's the one put in charge of storing up grains for the time of famine. And then when the famine comes, then not only do people from all the around the world come to Egypt to get grain, but also Jacob and his other sons, Joseph's brothers, come down into Egypt to buy grain. And actually, Jacob didn't go with them, but then later on, the whole family ends up coming down to Egypt during the time of Joseph. And so Joseph's father and brothers end up settling down in Egypt with their wives and children, and we're told at the end of the book of Genesis about 70 people in all. You may say 72, whatever. But you see kind of this starting to become this larger family. But then you turn to Exodus chapter 1, and many years have passed, about 400 years have passed. And it says that a new Pharaoh rose up that did not know Joseph. And he looks out and he sees all these Israelites, all these children of Jacob. And he's bothered by their numbers and so he starts putting the male children to death and things like that. And probably when it says a new Pharaoh rose up, it means a new dynasty. If you go back to, you know, and it, actually you don't have to go back many hundred years to see this, but a lot of places where they had kings, or in Egypt you had pharaohs, but you would have one line of royal descent, and then sometime along the way someone else would come in and take over, and so you'd have this new thing. The same thing happened in Egypt with pharaohs, where you had these different rulers, and then someone else would take over, and you'd have this new set of rulers. So probably this new dynasty takes over. And they look at the Jewish people as outsiders. And we're told from the story from Exodus chapter 1 that he put them to forced labor, to slavery. You know, and it is, you know, slavery was common in Egypt. You know, we look at the wonders of the ancient world. And of course, one of the great wonders of the ancient world is the pyramids down in Egypt. And obviously the pyramids didn't build themselves, and they weren't built with cranes and things like that that we use today to build skyscrapers, this fancy machinery that they didn't have back then. But the amazing sites that you find down in Egypt were built by slave labor. And then you get a little bit further in Exodus, and it talks about the story of the birth of this baby named Moses, who the name means draw out. He was drawn out of the waters. He was in a basket there, and he was drawn out of the water. But he's also going to one day, which I'm getting ahead of ourselves, but he's going to draw God's people out of Egypt. But there's this baby born, you know, at a time when they're trying to put infants to death, and he's put there in this basket and floating on the water and all of this, and you know that story. But there's a story of amazing birth and the preservation of this child, and it kind of reminds you of other stories in the Bible when you get to the New Testament, like the story of the birth of Jesus or the story of the birth of John the Baptist. When it stops and gives this story of somebody's birth, you know that this person is important. This person is significant. And this is, you know, miraculous events that surround the preservation of Moses. And he ends up going to the house. He was one of Pharaoh's daughters who finds him. He's put in this reed basket, found by the daughter of Pharaoh. And ends up, uses a Jewish midwife to nurse him, which happens to be Moses' mother. But anyway, when we find that he's adopted by one of Pharaoh's daughters, I mean, keep in mind, this is not a normal family. It's not a three-room house, and he's growing up in the very next room, you know, like you find in families today. I mean, pharaohs, like ancient kings, they would have large, you know, many wives and large harems and things like this. And so, you know, think of a palace or think of an area and territory. But anyway, it's still, nevertheless, he's adopted by the daughter of Pharaoh. And he grows up in the learning of the Egyptians. And then one day when he's around 40, he's outside, and he sees an Egyptian taskmaster mistreating a Hebrew slave, and so he intervenes and ends up killing the Egyptian. But then not much later on, the next day, he goes and he finds two Hebrews fighting, and he's wondering, why are you fighting with one another? And he tries to stop it, and one of them says, are you going to kill me like you did the Egyptian? And then he knows it's out. He knows people know. Somebody must have gone. And so it's probably this slave that was saved went back and told people what happened, but he's worried, you know, the word could get out. And so Moses flees. He goes far away. He settles down in the land of Midian, and he has a wife, and he has two children, and he's moved on, and he's far from Egypt, probably thinking he's never going to return again. But then we turn to Exodus chapter 3, and we have the story of Moses' call. And you all know the story. He sees off at a distance, he sees this bush burning, and it's not so much that a bush is burning, but he sees this bush is burning, and it keeps burning. It's not consumed. It doesn't go out. It's not the fact that he sees this strange fire, but he sees this fire that burns and burns, and the bush doesn't wither. The bush doesn't die. So he goes and he approaches, and you all know the story. He's told to take off his sandals, and I'm sure it's the technical Hebrew word for sandals there. No, I'm just kidding, but take off of what he's wearing, for the place that you are standing is holy ground. And he's told that I am the God of Abraham and Isaac and of Jacob. And keep in mind, we're talking 400 plus years. It's been 450 years since those days. And yet, he recalls the promises. I am the God of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob. And I have seen my people, I have seen their affliction, and I have heard the cry. And he tells Moses, go, I am going to send you back to Egypt to go before Pharaoh and to set my people free. And you know the story of Moses' call. He's reluctant to go. And there's pros and cons about that. You know, a lot of people get to the end. He gives various excuses. I'm not very eloquent. We'll take your brother Aaron with you. You know, he can speak. You know, all of these things. And then finally he says, I'm not going. And so, you know, that seems rather bold. And you've got to understand, I mean, the Pharaoh is the most powerful person in the world in that day and time, at least in that part of the world. He's the most powerful person. And you know, to go before the most powerful person in the world, and you're going to go, and you're going to confront them, and you're going to tell him, let my people go. But I think there's something else. And you know, he does, he seems rather strong in his denial. There's also, I think, pros to that. Oftentimes, in the Old Testament, we find out some of the great prophets and leaders are somewhat reluctant. And one of the things that's going to be said about Moses later on, as he's, you know, as he's dying and things like that, and in the book of Deuteronomy, is that he was the most humble man in all the earth. And I think there's a certain humility that's important for great leaders. And, you know, there's a realization of this task that's at hand. And to think I'm not up to that task is probably exactly right, because Moses, by his own strength and willpower, is probably not up to the task that God is setting him out for. But think about this. Moses has been gone. He's settled in the land of Midian. He has these children. He's been gone for 40 years. He probably doesn't think he's, you know, ever going back to Egypt. In his younger days, he had wanted to see his people liberated. He didn't like their mistreatment. He killed an Egyptian. But now, 40 years later, he's in Midian with his wife and family. But according to God, his time is not done yet. No, and I was thinking about, as I was preparing this sermon today, or for today, you know, how I go, you know, I'm talking about important events in Scripture, and I thought how I go directly from the call of Abraham to another call, the call of Moses. And I struggled with it a bit. Did I really want to focus on the call of Moses? You know, and there's a part of me that wanted to talk about Joseph and his, you know, his going down into Egypt, but I decided to pass on that. If you're talking about the important events in Scripture, you got to really focus on the big points, the biggest ones, and things like that. And so then I wondered, do I skip straight to the Exodus? But I decided I wanted to come back and spend some time on the call of Moses. Of course, you don't have a nation of Israel without Abraham, their forefather. But I think you could almost equally argue you don't have a nation of Israel without Moses. You know, you have these promises that were made to the ancestors. I'm going to make you a great nation. I'm going to give you many descendants. I'm going to give you a land. And through your seed, all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. You have those glorious promises, but 400 years have passed. And the people of Israel are down in Egypt. And they are slaves. They seem a long way from becoming a nation. And the promises don't seem very likely. I mean, in one sense, the promises have started to come to fruition. They're growing in numbers. Now there's a large multitude of them, large numbers of them. In Egypt, the family of Jacob had grew and become prolific. What started out as 12 sons and their families, about 7 people at all at the end of Genesis, you turn to the opening chapter of Exodus and they become exceedingly great in number. But they're slaves in Egypt. They're far from the promised land. certainly not an independent nation, but they're slaves, and they seem powerless. So the question is, how do they go from being these slaves down in Egypt, and at the time you have no Israel and no promised land, to a relatively short time later having the people and the nation of Israel living in the promised land? And really a very important part of that story is the call of Moses. Moses is called. He goes back to Egypt. He becomes, in their history, known as the one who delivered them out of Egypt. He's the one who revealed the prophet, who revealed, you know, God's law to them. Moses is a human leader that leads them out of Egypt and sets them free. It's through the prophet Moses that God gives them the law. It's through the prophet Moses that God gives them their tabernacle, the tent of meeting, this meeting place between them and God. It's through Moses' brother Aaron that God gives them the priesthood. And again, it's through Moses that he gives him the instructions about the priesthood. It is Moses who leads them through the wilderness to the promised land, even though it ends up being his successor, Joshua, that actually leads them into the promised land. You know, and I was thinking this week, you know, I was thinking some, and I hate to use this analogy, and I mentioned it a while back, but I don't use it very much. But if I were to make a Mount Rushmore of the most important people in Western civilization, I would very much consider putting Moses on that list. Of course, Mount Rushmore is the you know, monument in the U.S. where we have four presidents. We have Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, and Teddy Roosevelt are the four presidents that are on Mount Rushmore, but I've heard it used, and actually I hate to admit, where I've heard it used a lot is on sports radio. They talk about, you know, use the example, who would be the Mount Rushmore of college football coaches? And you have these debates, who are the four best all-time most important college football coaches? Or you know, you could have this, you know, who's the Mount Rushmore of NFL quarterbacks? If you could only choose four, who would be your top four? And so you get into these debates, you know, Montana and Brady and Marino, but Marino never won a championship. And so is he included or not? You know, even though he had those, you know, all of these things. But if you only had four, but when you stop and think about Judaism and Christianity's influence on the world, and not only the West, I think very much the West, but even in the East, places like Soviet Union that was Christian for hundreds and hundreds of years, or Georgia, Eastern European places and parts of Asia. But the influence of not only Judaism, but Christianity, which comes out of Judaism all over the world. There's a compelling case that could be made that Moses should be on the Mount Rushmore of civilization. Now, of course, we don't know what Moses looked like, although many of you may think he looked like Charlton Heston. But again, you think about the law of Moses and the influence that has had on many laws throughout our history and things like that. And I know there were other laws before that, but the law of Moses has had a tremendous impact on later civilizations. You know, and then, you know, you think about the Israel, their tabernacle, the worship, the sacrifices, the son of the people of Israel, the son of the tribe of Judah, of Jesus, and things like that. But Moses is the one who, you know, who led them out of Egypt, that helped them to become a nation, who gave them a law, who gave them the law that stands today, who they go from being a people who were in many ways not a people, to a people that end up inheriting the promised land from whom Jesus goes to. And so again, I just to me, it's almost hard to overstate the influence of Moses on Israel's history, and I would say by consequence, almost on world history. They go from being slaves down in Egypt to being a nation with a land. And of course, the last part of that, the very last part of that, belongs to Joshua. But the biggest part of that takes place under the leadership of Moses. Now, having said all of this, if you go into many bookstores and study the history of Israel and things like that, there's a lot of liberal biblical scholars out there and liberal scholars that have raised questions about the authenticity of the biblical story. Some have even questioned if there really was a Moses or if the descendants of Israel were really slaves in Egypt. And one of the things that the scholars commonly cite is the almost total lack of sources that verify these events outside of Israel, outside of the Bible. And I've got a few thoughts in response to that, if anybody ever reads something like that, but this is my thoughts for what they're worth. I remember reading one quote one time, and I don't remember who it is, but he said something to the effect that he had no doubt that history was written by the finger of God. But he said, but do we have the text? And the point he was making is what we know of ancient history, the sources we have are the fragments. That we have, you know, a source over here that tells us about something, and that may be the only source we have that tells us about this event. Or there's a source over here that tells us about something else. But there's a lot of ancient history that you know, maybe if new archaeological discoveries come upon something, we'll know about. But there's a lot of ancient history that we don't know. What we have are the pieces and the fragments that have been preserved. And so one is, you know, later in Israel's story, you're going to find more external sources. For instance, there are sources referring to the house of Omri in the northern kingdom of Israel, and there's a lot of writings about the house of Omri. You may not know much about Omri, but you probably know about his son Ahab and Ahab's wife Jezebel, who's very famous in Israel's history. But so there are some external sources that lend credence to the Bible. And I pointed this out before, for many years and for a long time, people doubted the existence of Pontius Pilate, who, of course, was the Roman ruler under which Jesus was put to death until, you know, and I forget when it was now, the 1930s or somewhere along there, that they discovered the Pilate Stone. And now no one questions what's famously become known as the Pilate Stone. No one questions whether Pontius Pilate was a ruler in first century Israel. And I know that's much later, much after the time of Moses. But if you're expecting contemporary sources, which there aren't many of, outside of Israel to record what happened with the people of Israel when they were slaves in Egypt and going into the promised land, you should almost expect to be disappointed. Because there's just, you know, not a lot of collaboration of a lot of ancient historical events. There is a lack of sources on many, many events in ancient history, and we should not really, I don't think, expect that anyone but the Jews would tell their story. Number two, if you know anything about Egyptian history, Egyptian sources and Egyptian pharaohs have a history of exaggerating their victories and not mentioning their losses. And so do you think that the Egyptians are going to want to report about a story about where a bunch of slaves get away and flee from the land of Egypt and things like that? That just doesn't happen. I mean, if they had a loss in a battle, the pharaohs and the writers of Egyptian history would gloss over their losses. But if there was a victory, they would emphasize that victory and they would magnify it. And so, you know, it's not the sort of thing that the powers that be in Egypt would want to record. And some also would mention it's not a significant event to them like it was the people of Israel. But on the other hand, what we do know that some of the names like Moses and even the midwives, Shipra and Puah, were Egyptian names. Obviously, Moses has a Hebrew meaning as well, but most scholars think that the name comes from an Egyptian background and Egyptian influence. We do know there were large building projects going on in the northern part of Egypt during the time that the Israelites were down there by Ramses II and others. And that those building projects were indeed done, as I talked about earlier, were being done by slave labor. I mentioned the pyramids and how they were built and things like that. But there were, you know, these expansive building projects going on in Egypt at the time, as Exodus describes, and those involved large numbers of slave labor. You have in the 13th century in Israel, a lot of towns of Israel are destroyed, something similar to what we have under Joshua. And there are questions about some of the dates. I'm not saying that it's clear cut all the time. But then if you stop and think back and just back off for a second and think about that, you have the fact that at a certain point in history, a nation of Israel comes to exist in the Promised Land. And they worship the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They worship Yahweh. First as 12 tribes, and then as a united nation under David and Solomon. And so you have this fundamental question, where did they come from and how did they come to exist? And obviously liberal scholars will have different theories about that. But there's no doubt that you have this phenomenon that at some point in history, you have this people called Israel, whereas earlier on there is no nation of Israel. And this people is worshiping their God with distinct religious beliefs and with the unique law. And I know there was the code of Hammurabi and other law codes, but I still think there's something special and unique about their beliefs and their practices and things like that. And if you let them tell their own story, which they told and they told and they told over and over again, consistently throughout the Old Testament, in the Psalms, in the prophets, in the historical books, their story is that they were slaves in Egypt. But God drew them out of Egypt with an outstretched hand and a mighty arm, and he brought them into the land. And some have pointed out the idea that Israel would make up this story about being slaves just makes no sense. It's not the story you'd want to make up, that, yeah, our ancestors were a bunch of slaves down in Egypt. There was a writer about the history of Israel, a famous book that's been, you know, republished several editions by a man by the name of John Bright, who was kind of a liberal slash conservative scholar. He was somewhere in between. But he said if you were to do away with Moses, that you would have to invent someone else by the same name to replace him, because he's just pointing that you can't tell the story of the history of the people of Israel without talking about Moses. There's another book I got from the ACU library. It's called Israel and Egypt, The Evidence for the Authenticity of the Exodus Tradition. It was written in the 90s by a man named James Hoffmeyer. If someone wants to get me a birthday present sometime, just to add that. No, I'm just kind of aside. But anyway, you know, are there external sources outside the Bible that 100% prove the Exodus traditions? And I would say no. But if you were to ask a different question, but does what we read in the Old Testament fit with what we know was going on in the ancient Near East at that time? I would say yes. And of course, as I go back to 400 years had passed, a long time since Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They had these glorious promises. They probably wondered, are these promises ever coming to fruition? But then you have the call of Moses. And Moses becomes the one who becomes deliverer, he becomes lawgiver, he becomes the one who leads them through the wilderness and takes them to the edge of the promised land. So I've talked about the importance of Moses, but I do want to qualify it a little bit. Because as the Bible makes very clear, Moses was God's instrument to do God's work. Amen. I talked before about him being a reluctant leader, and I think we see something there, you know, his humility as well as his reluctance. But I think, you know, part of his being a reluctant leader, it kind of also emphasizes that it's God working through this human leader that wasn't so sure this was a good idea for him ever to go back to Egypt. But Scripture makes it clear when they tell the stories time and time again, and I've always loved Psalm 77, but I want to read you a few verses for it, because it makes it clear this story is God's story, and God is the one who's bringing about these events. Says in the latter part, the psalm starts out very gloomy. Maybe that's why I like it. It starts out very gloomy, but gets better towards the end. But verse 14, we're only dealing with the good part this morning. You are the God who performs miracles. You display your power among the peoples. With your mighty arm, you redeemed your people, the descendants of Jacob and Joseph. The waters saw you, God. The waters saw you, O God. And they were dismayed. The very depths trembled. The clouds poured out water. The heavens resounded with thunder. Your arrows flashed on every side. Your thunder was heard in the whirlwind. Your lightning lit up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your path was through the sea. You led your way through the mighty waters. Though your footprints were unseen, you led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. So who led the people through the sea? You read all of that. It's God leading his people. It's God setting them free. But then it says at the very end, by the hand of Moses and Aaron. And I think it's a little bit misnomer, you know, and I've talked about it already this morning, but I talked about the law of Moses. And we call it the law of Moses. But really what we call the law of Moses isn't Moses' law, it's God's law. It's the law of God. He revealed his law through Moses. But it's God who says, have no other God before me. It's God who says to honor your father and mother, that Moses wasn't inventing these laws. He was just the prophet. He received the teaching from God. And he passed it on to the people. Same way when we get back to the tabernacle, it's God who gave instructions about the building of the tabernacle in which he would come and dwell among his people. Moses was a great human leader. But again, we go back even to the title of the sermon this morning. It says the call of Moses. Well, who called Moses? It was God who called Moses. And he was directed by God each step of the way. It's God is the one who performed the mighty, you know, the mighty miracles down there in Egypt, what we call the plagues, who brought deliverance out of Egypt. It was God who provided for them in the wilderness. It was God who gave his law through the prophet Moses at Sinai. It was God who gave them the land, a land flowing with milk and honey. But God chose the right leader at the right time to bring about his purposes. Amen. If there's anyone that needs to come for any reason, we invite you to come. All together we stand and we sing.